symptoms such as headaches, dizziness, and this long-haul COVID among the farm worker population is very worrisome, since they wouldn't have any access to a security net, a social security net, a backup net, and they continue to feel ill after having recovered from COVID.
I want to thank you both for being with us. In the U.S., we call it long haulers, and the rest of the world, they call it long COVID, those that suffer from COVID for many, many months since they have gotten it. Mary Jo Dudley, director of the Cornell Farm Worker Program, faculty member at Cornell's University's Department of Global Development, and Estela Cisneros, speaking to us from Modesto, California, legal director of the California Rural Legal Assistance's Agriculture Worker Program. That does it for our show, Democracy Now!, produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Taracena, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Trina Nadura.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. The time is 7:59 a.m. Next up, we have Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Rowland.
And good morning, everybody. This is your host, Paul Rowland. Good morning. I'm with you every Wednesday morning from 8 to 9. On the other days of the week, you can hear other talk show hosts speaking about important issues of the day. It is the first Wednesday of the month, and longtime listeners know that I, for quite a while, was doing a first Wednesday focus on mental health and mental liberation, issues regarding the treatment of people in mental, psychic, emotional distress, and similar issues. Been on hiatus for a while. I'm not saying I'm going to continue to do that every first Wednesday, but it's good to be back with that theme. And in fact, I'm going to have one of my guests, Kevin Fitz, has been on my program before. So I'm going to be talking about new approaches to people in mental and emotional crisis, along with Kevin and Janie Gullickson. I'll introduce them in a second. So people are quite familiar with the issue of people who are in such crisis being in, unfortunately, the crosshairs of police departments around the country because of, a lack of imagination, funds, institutional prerogatives, whatever, cultural attitudes. In any case, people who are experiencing psychic distress, behavioral issues, especially in public, tend to die at the hands of police or get caught up in a system that often does not serve their best interests. Oregon is, as in many things, leading the way and is pointing to new directions. First, the new Portland Street Response Teams that has a pilot program going on in Lentz right now, which I had that up, but I'll ask Kevin and Janie to talk all about that. It pairs a social worker with other people to de-escalate a situation where someone is in crisis and try to point them to healthy options rather than ending up in jail, which has basically become a major default temporary solution to the lack of a better systemic way of dealing. And now a new bill, House Bill 2980, would provide funding for 3 peer respite centers, short-term home-like facilities for people experiencing mental health crises. Currently, people suffering such crises often end up in jail or emergency rooms, neither of which are equipped to handle them. The bill proposes instead to create safe places where people who've had mental health crises themselves, i.e. peers, would provide the services. And of course, peer support is an issue I've talked quite a bit on my show in the past. So without further ado, Kevin Fitz is the executive director of the Oregon Mental Health Consumers Association, and Janie Gullickson is executive director of the Mental Health and Addiction Association of Oregon. Welcome to you both. Hi, Kevin. Hi, Janie.
Good morning.
Good morning, Paul.
Good morning. Okay, so let me just turn
good morning,
to you, Janie.
Janie.
I think you're going to be on a little bit
shorter,
a little bit shorter, so we can have callers because we're all three on the phone. As I've said in the past on this show, our phone system isn't set up for handling all three of us plus listeners calling in, which is what call-in radio is all about. So talk about your organization and your work, Janie.
Yeah, thanks. The Mental Health and Addiction Association of Oregon is a peer-run organization. You know, most of the 70-plus staff identify as having a lived experience of mental health and or addiction recovery challenges, issues, however someone wants to identify, as well as over half our board. And we provide direct peer support services in the Portland metro area, as well as provide peer training for certification, technical assistance, and we have our annual peer leadership conference, Peerpocalypse.
Great. Kevin?
Yeah. So I am a volunteer with a tiny little mental health policy nonprofit called the Oregon Mental Health Consumers Association. We were founded in 2002 with the specific goal of helping to increase the consumer within our public health systems, particularly behavioral health and mental health systems, to increase and support the voice of the service recipient, the consumer, in mental health policy and systems across the region. And to that degree, we attempt to do that by making room at boards, councils, committees, processes, advisory, ongoing things, and making sure or doing our best to help raise the voice of the consumer within the within our behavioral health systems.
And of course, I'll add at the outset a third issue of certainly of no less importance right now than the other two is COVID-19, which is adding so much stress to everybody, to people on an individual basis, and no doubt contributing to people being in crisis, but also to the system's ability, already stretched ability, to handle such crises. And we can tackle that within the conversation as well. But Janie, so I mentioned the Portland street response. That wasn't the initial thing that Kevin reached out to me to talk about. He was obviously this Oregon House bill upcoming is a huge deal for these peer respite centers. But you know, people before they end up in either jail or psychiatric units, people have confrontations, perhaps with their families, perhaps with friends, people in public, strangers, and then possibly with the police. And so this Portland street response seems to be another major step in creating more options for people. You know, obviously the respite centers would be another layer for people to be able to be directed to a different place. But maybe both of you want to just first talk about your impressions. Have you heard about how that program is going, or just what you think about such programs? Janie first.
Sure. So while I am not exactly sure, you know, the numbers that Portland Street Response has been able to serve, as they are, this is almost a pilot project in the Lentz neighborhood, so it is focused in a pretty small area of Portland. But I think, you know, as an alternative to, you know, the police coming out or some other, you know, more traumatizing interaction, I think it's a great alternative to that and can hopefully help people in the moment with some understanding and some options that haven't existed before in Portland. I know, you know, we do have, there are police that are trained in ECIT, which is that enhanced crisis intervention training. But again, police shouldn't be the first response. And so really looking forward to, you know, learning more about Portland Street Response and how it's working.
And Kevin, I'll turn that same question over to you. But maybe you could sort of explore further, just to sort of tease out what are the, you know, what are people faced with right now, if they, you know, if they deal with the police, or even if they deal with the Portland Street Response Team, right now.
I just want to say is that some of the danger we're talking about is looking, you know, at a limb. Without talking about the body, or as my sociology professor used to say, you spend a lot of time navel gazing and trying to self or get a diagnosis of what is the matter with you, particular human, versus is there something around the matter with the community. So let me just put this more plainly. So say that I'm in Lent, and I'm not. This isn't a criticism. I think these movements towards more compassionate, gentle, non-coercive outreach are fantastic, and I think they should bloom all over the place. But just let me say this, and I think it would come with a presupposition of what the previous normal was. I'm in Lentz. I'm walking around. I'm talking to myself. I'm combative. Someone sees me. They say that person looks like their bandages are not wrapped too tightly, or their elevator's not going all the way to the top. And in any case, the people reach out to me and they say, well, what's going on? I say, well, I have no house, I have no family, and I have no meaningful relationships where people reflect care and empathy and kindness for me. They see me either as a public nuisance or a person without a house, and they resent that I'm that I'm unprettifying up the neighborhood with, you know, with my affective behavior or my littering or whatever. For me, well, first of all, we need to give you a number and an insurance classification so we can set you on your journey to be diagnosed as having a mental illness. I don't like that particular language. I think somewhere in some of these processes that we're looking at the after effect instead of starting on ground zero of saying we live in a very dysfunctional culture, a dysfunctional society. People have challenges with their own emotions and own thoughts, but they're never pathologized because they have a house and they have relationships and they have family. Some of these ideas, I think, need to where do we go? So the street response is a great idea, but where do they plug you into? Are you mentally ill, or are you not getting your needs met as a human, and that has torqued up your motor and people want to put a butterfly net over you and take you, you know, to some place where they can contain you for public safety's sake? Some of this stuff sort of seems like a merry-go-round. You can prettify the front entrance to the plantation, but it still is a plantation. And I'm not saying that so concertedly about our public mental health systems, but we forgot that these are people who have severe needs and those needs aren't getting met. Before we start cycling them through, you know, our emergency or our, we need to label them, and then we need to psychiatrically treat them. And then what do we do with them? We have no place for them to live. We can't find a community where they can be accepted in. I think some of the, I think sometimes we're, like I said, we're looking at the end product and not looking at what the some of the causes and what generates this stuff. So sorry for that long-winded.
That really sets the kind of the framework of the discussion really well. I would just urge you to watch your language on this program. So now you're talking basically about the sort of an implicit criticism, not of the Portland response teams, but of the before and after of what people need in order to not get into crisis, and then to deal with whatever crisis they might be in. And the system doesn't, our system in general doesn't provide very good ways of dealing with that at present. And so, Jane, let me back to you. This I kind of wanted to talk a little bit more generally about the whole issue of peer support, a little bit about its history, because I understand that that these peer respite centers that are proposed now under this Oregon House bill, which we'll talk about more fully as we go along, Oregon House Bill 2980, that peer respite centers actually have existed more in the past, and they are sort of, I guess some have continued to exist, or they're kind of coming back. Want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I think peer support, on the 70s, 80s was more, a natural thing. People were finding that, they weren't getting the support or the help they needed, and found that others, having gone through similar situations and did not find the system or the lack of the system helpful, the medicalized forced treatment of folks was not something that, helped any situation but caused more trauma. And then it started getting funded, and like you said, there were probably, more places for folks to go. Kevin made such great points and set the stage about sort of that journey of a person where you finally see them publicly in crisis and really society's reaction and discomfort to that, and not having a solution, but just please, get them out of my sight, out of my neighborhood, because they make me uncomfortable or I don't feel safe. And there was this funding of places for people to build community, to whether it was drop-in centers, recovery centers, peer respite-like places and communities. And then it went away. Funding got dropped, and I'm not sure what happened, and Kevin may have more insight to this, but now we're finding, and it's been a long, hard fight, that peer support, peer respite, and alternatives to this medical model, diagnosis-focused, medication-focused system, we're trying really hard to advocate and seeing some movement in peer support and recognizing it as a best practice, as a trauma-informed care service. And peer respite is also hopefully going to be something that we see not only fills a gap, but really offers dignity and support and less traumatizing response than what Oregon has offered before.
So turn it back to you, Kevin. Again, just explore a little further. So what, say someone, the hypothetical person walking around in Lentz, who either previously would, confront the police, or even the street response team. What what sort of options? We'll go into the Oregon House bill in just a couple minutes and go deeper into that and what your efforts are to pass that legislation, some of the more details of it. But where would a person go like that right now go? Jail or where?
So it's the, I think that if my understanding is that they would get they would have contact with the street response, and then there would be a clinical orientation or some clinical judgment of, does this person need more psychiatric assessment? What is the need that this person is going through? And so what that looks like is some sort of greater psychiatric assessment would be on, do someone on the team believe this person is a danger to self or others, by the legal statutes? And then that would pull them down one particular way. If there was somebody who had some understanding about what helps them, and if they, whether it was some sort of medication or some sort of support group, they would attempt to plug a person in to that particularly. One thing I want to back up and say, peer respite really sort of started again, at conceptually, and got off the ground in New Hampshire in the late 90s. I actually flew out there. The state of Oregon paid me to go out there to look at what was being called peer respite. And currently there are 14 or 15 states that have peer respites, some three or four of them. Some are just starting out with one, some smaller states. Why are there not more peer respites? And one of the reasons is it's not so much that people in the industry are against peer respites, is that the biggest lobbyists in the game are the pharmaceutical companies and the profiteering Medicaid managed care companies. Now, both of those folks, or both of those groups, have been very supportive of peer respite, to me and to people supporting our bill or our previous bills. However, they are nobody at the state capitol in Oregon or any other state capitol I know that gets paid to support peer respite or peer support initiatives as a full-time lobbyist job. There's nobody carrying the banner to raise the awareness of why this is a very valuable, needed service. So there's that. So ideally, does a person have an I don't know exactly the language, and I don't want to offend the viewers, but when we're talking about a person having an acute psychiatric crisis, does that go from 0 to 60 or to 0 to the boundary of cannot contain it and manage it over in a split second? No, it doesn't happen. Episodes come on, I think, sometimes, at least in my experience, like weather fronts. And the more that you get some nuance in trying to understand that and manage and do some self-care about looking at what's popping within your mind, that can be very helpful. And ideally, so why don't we have it here in Oregon? Because it's a need that the system doesn't recognize it needs. We need voluntary intermediate supports for people who are interested in amping up their self-management, symptomatology management game before the lid blows off. But we don't have those places to tell those stories. Someone was escalating and they spent 3 or 4 days getting psychological and emotional support from people who have been through that grinder and been through those extreme states, but nothing else is asked for them. No coercion, no necessary psychiatric ongoing diagnosis or forced treatment. That can be the currency of our system, should be a trust. Where does the person in psychic distress find a port in the storm of somebody they can trust? And peer respite is telling that story. Like I said, in 14 other states, there's 34 of them coming. COVID put a brief pause on some of the development, but I expect there will probably be peer respite in every single state, ongoing. Once we start to get more data and we start to educate the rest of the system, it's not just Medicaid managed care companies and psychiatric pharmaceutical companies who dictate what service should be on the ground. So, does that make sense, or did I skirt your question?
No. This is an ongoing conversation, and you'll be with us for the hour. I want to get back to Janie a second, so she's gonna leave us a little sooner. But I wanted to just flag one thing you said, which sort of in a way corrects how I laid it out. Obviously, these peer respite centers aren't for, and if it passes in Oregon and they start coming here, they're not just for people in that acute moment of crisis that you kind of laid out with that hypothetical person walking around in Lentz. They're actually designed for so people don't get to that point. They're places where people can go and you know, as you said, sort of de-escalate themselves before they escalate to that point. I want to get into. It's a complicated question. I know there's crisis lines for people in distress. Obviously, for people who you know, have insurance or can afford it, there's therapy. As you so explained so well, Kevin, there's now the dominant model of pharmaceuticals to manage these issues, which have their own issues that we can talk about. I've talked about in some guests on this show quite a bit about that. And then there's various crisis centers, hospitals. The Unity Center is the newest addition to it. Anyway, so let me turn it back to you, Janie. You talked about, you know, peers who would run these peer respite centers, who run peer support organizations like your own, have had the lived experience, and so the both the knowledge and presumably the empathy to deal with people. You want to possibly talk, I don't want to put you on the spot, you can pass, obviously, but maybe just talk about, like, when you were in crisis, what sort of options did you have in front of you, and did you have something like a peer respite center?
Well, just to directly answer your question about did I have access to a peer respite center, the answer is no, not at all. When I was experiencing very public mental health crisis and on the streets, no matter if it was daytime, nighttime, the first response, first interaction was law enforcement. And then I was either, you know, taken to jail or taken by ambulance to an emergency department. And then from the emergency department to oftentimes a locked psychiatric ward in the hospital for a week or so. And then given lots of medications. And when I was released, sent back out into the world without any resources. Peer support wasn't, you know, offered or mainstream in Oregon at the time. Certainly not a profession that was, or a support service that was available or offered. So could I have benefited from a peer respite? Absolutely. Over and over again. And I think, you know, it's not a one and done thing. And as you said before, it could be something that people can go to before the mega crisis, before, you know, before someone is standing in the middle of the street in full-blown distress. And that's what's missing. Because folks have nowhere to go, and if they don't have a therapist on speed dial that's available 24/7, or some, you know, friend or family member that hasn't been exhausted or isn't in, you know, some sort of crisis themselves in this pandemic, where does one go? One shows up at, even, you know, it makes sense. I'll go to the psychiatric hospital, you know, emergency department. And then still being told, well, you're not bad enough to be, you know, you're not in deep enough crisis to be inpatient. Here, you can hang out here for 24 hours, or we're going to just say, you know, we can't serve you. Here's a here's your street roots book, out you go. Or you're in an emergency department, again, not bad enough, out you go. Or maybe you're on a hold for a few days and committed for a short period of time, and then what? So that's some huge issues with the system of care.
Those are great points, Mike. Can I interrupt to poke a question at Janie about where do you go? And you brought it up, Paul, about COVID. Janie, why don't you tell us about peergalaxy.com and regarding the peer culture and the peer world about getting mutual support?
Yeah, I think one of the huge, added, added offerings that we have discovered in, or that has been discovered during COVID has been, virtual support and even more available, free and accessible if one has technology, and Peer Galaxy is one of those offerings, and it is incredible. It's a calendar that features over 10,000 monthly offerings of free online and telephone accessible peer support. There's recovery meetings, wellness activities. There's something for everyone, and it's so well organized. I have continually been so impressed and in awe of Peer Galaxy and how it is user friendly. There's over 25 warm lines. There's consumer stakeholder input opportunities. It's peergalaxy.com, easy to access, easy to explore, and it's really focused on Oregon, but also beyond Oregon as well.
Wow, that's great. I hadn't heard of that. That sounds like something fairly new. So we're halfway through the show, Janie, and as I had put out, we can have listeners call in for at least half the show. You've agreed to bow out and let Kevin take the other available line.
Well, we'll see and my guest. At the end of the hour whether I should have bowed out and Janie should have stayed. Thank you so much, Janie.
Well, I guess you can fight it out on the air right now, or you could, I don't know, you could play a game to see who goes. Anyway, I'm just kidding. But Janie, before you go, don't leave yet. I'd like you before we go to that, I should have said this at the very beginning. The Portland response teams include, it's a team of four with a firefighter EMT, a licensed mental health crisis therapist, and two community health workers. And they're working now Monday through Friday in Lentz, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m., and then a similar second team will be added 6 months later. I think they've been around for, was it 2 or 3 months? I don't know exactly, but to cover the same area but respond at night and on the weekends. So that's what's going on with the Portland Street Response teams. And I think we'll lay that part of the discussion to rest. But before you go, Janie, and I want to put the number out, 503-231-8187. That's the number to call in as soon as there's a line available in a couple minutes, 503-231-8187. My guests are Kevin Fitz and Janie Gullickson. So, Janie, introduce this legislation and why you're so excited about it.
Yeah, House Bill 2980 will fund peer respites, three of them across the state, hopefully one focused on being culturally responsive, culturally specific peer respite. And I am so excited because time is beyond needed. We've had this gap in our system of care for far too long, and it is cost effective. It's that crisis alternative. It diverts hospitalization, not only the cost that comes with that, but then the cost to the consumer, the person who's seeking care. They are staffed, operated by peers that are trained in providing crisis support, who can build that mutual trusting relationship, sometimes ongoing relationship. Peer respites are in a home setting, in a residential neighborhood. It's that home-like environment with you're surrounded by people who've been there, done that, who get it. And really at its core, that's why I'm so excited.
Great. And I read here in the Willamette Week article that I quoted in my program page at kboo.fm, where you can find that and other interesting links. There will be three centers, one in the Portland metro area, one in Southern Oregon, and a third in Eastern Oregon, which obviously will go a short ways, but not all that far to meeting the crisis. But obviously, it's sort of a, like the Portland street response is kind of a pilot. And if I presume, if it proves, as you're saying, cost-effective and effective for the people themselves, then it will presumably have the chance to expand. Okay, thank you so much, Janie Gullickson, Executive Director of the Mental Health and Addiction Association of Oregon. Really appreciate your taking time to be with us.
Thank you, Paul. And thanks, Kevin. Great opportunity to share with you today. Looking forward to a future opportunity.
Okay. And I still have with me Kevin Fitz with the Oregon Mental Health Consumers Association, who's been fighting these battles, as it were, for many years since his own experience, which you've shared on this program in the past, if you feel it's relevant. I just thought it's really important. Janie explained so well her own experience and how her own example was the best evidence for why these peer respite centers and other different kinds of approaches to people in mental, psychic, emotional crisis and distress are needed. And you yourself have gone through your own issues and run-ins with these situations. Again, if you want to bring that to bear as it's relevant, I'll invite you to do that, but also yourself talk about how you see this going. What, give us maybe a little timeline on this Oregon House bill. Has it been introduced? Who's supporting it? What kind of support does it have?
Very good. So first, just leveling. So House Bill 2980 is a peer respite bill, and it purports to fund three peer respite facilities, non-medicalized, non-clinical facilities. These are for psychological and emotional support for people in intermediate stages of a psychiatric or acute distress. That, and I don't like the language, but the law suggests that if you are a danger to yourself or others, that they have the right to contain you. We're not talking to that people at that point. But I want to put the point out there. Say, for example, I have had many, many extreme states that had ended up in the jail and or the psych ward. Had the opportunity on, say, a Friday evening to go, you know, with some support from friends or family to say, hey, it seems like you're having a hard time, or I am having a hard time. Maybe I could use some psychological and emotional support at a peer respite for a 3 to 5 day period. However, those are not available. And so what you get when you present at the emergency room is, you do not meet criteria. We are full, and the only people we are admitting are those people who meet criteria to put a hold on. And you have to be a danger to yourself or others, and that has to be somewhat demonstrable to the eyes of the clinicians at the emergency room or at the Unity site crisis. This would intervene and have an earlier intervention and be led by the peer community, educating the rest of the system, take advantage of this particular resource. My partner of 20 years, her testimony suggested we were asked to move 3 times in a 1 year period. Why is that? Because after hours, when I was going through an extreme state of deep, deep fearfulness, suspicion, and rage, the emergency room said, you don't meet criteria, go back home. And if things get worse, call the crisis line. There was no peer respite that my partner could have helped me check into for a 3 to 5 day period or 7 day period to you know, to get some needed support but the only thing we either have your house, the crisis line, or the cops coming to your door, or the psych ward, or the jail. We need some intermediate steps in between that gray area. One, because it's so important for the patient, the client, the service recipient to start understanding skill building on how to manage their extreme states in a way that benefits their wellness, particularly. And we also, too, the currency of this system is not money. The currency of the system from the point of view of the consumer is, who do I trust with my vulnerability and these thoughts and moods that I'm going through that are causing great distress for me? And why is that? In the peer community, is you connect to a peer respite, you learn about the peer culture, the mutual support, just like Alcoholics Anonymous, just like breast cancer survivors, just like vets who came back from Vietnam. They all huddled together because they weren't getting necessary support in the larger macro culture. And the peer movement has created those culture because it's important, because some of us are like those people, without housing, without friends, without family, and has been rejected and discriminated against because of our psychiatric labels. So building a culture of unpaid friends who care about you, who have experienced the same sort of shame and discrimination, can be a very meaningful fork in the road for people like me, and I suspect for people like our friend Janie. This bill has had. Go ahead. I wanted to. The bill has.
No. You get to the nuts and bolts, and then I'll come back.
Okay. So this bill, House Bill 2980, is more or less a recycle of the previous long legislative session in 2019 called House Bill 2831, which passed the Behavioral Health Committee, or passed the Health Committee in the House 2 years ago. It did not make it to the Ways and Means Committee to be funded. This bill currently, House Bill 2980, in Representative Tana Sanchez's Behavioral Health Committee on the House side, had a hearing. It already had a hearing, and it had significant testimony, very supportive testimony from clinicians, from people who run helplines, and from consumers and peers. The next step is a work session in that committee to look at, we put in some amendment language to designate clearly one of these will be an operated project either by an Oregon tribe or by a BIPOC-led or a peer-run organization. And that's part of the amendment, and then just straightening up some of the fiscal. So there will be a work session in the Behavioral Health Committee to decide whether to move this bill forward to Ways and Means to see if they have the money or want to fund it. So that's where it is currently. We are still waiting to see if that work session, when that will be scheduled.
Okay. And thank you for that. I did put out that the number to call in is 503-231-8187. We have about 20 minutes left. We do have one caller already. I urge people to get their calls in as soon as Camilo is off. But Camilo, what are you wanting to contribute to the conversation?
Well, I can appreciate that the focus has been chiefly on crises and how to deal with crises. But I think crises don't occur out of the blue. They develop over a long period of time. And I think in order to deal with the crisis, we need a system for that. But we also need a way of implementing support for people who can be seen early before the crises become so crucial, so critical. And I just wonder if we could focus a little bit on earlier kinds of opportunities for some support and intervention before crises develop.
Well, do you have any thoughts on that yourself?
Well, I am a retired child and adolescent psychiatrist, so of course my focus would be on making available services for people as early in their life as possible, and that means support for families and enough facilities within the system to have availability for somebody who needs this kind of help. You know, my career is in New York, so I'm not really familiar with the system out here, so I can't be very specific about it. But, you know, it's apparent that people develop problems early in life that, you know, don't get attended to or are misunderstood. And, you know, then they get older and situations become critical. There's an emergency. But I think if they were attended to much earlier than that, then these could have been foreseen and avoided.
Of course. You, I'm sure, would no doubt agree, as well as Kevin, that, and we sort of alluded to it, obviously, the deeper solutions are a change to the highly individualistic, cutthroat, competitive, capitalist, colonial, racist system that we live in. But short of finally overthrowing that and living the way we're meant to live on this planet Earth, that's a totally, we do have to deal institutionally, you know, in our daily lives. So, Kevin, let me just throw that over to you. You've sort of talked already a little bit about that. You want to address Camilla's question about how to, you know, go back to maybe, you know, for yourself, before you were in your moment of crisis, what sort of help could you have used?
Yeah, well, let me just say I agree 100% with what he said, particularly about early interventions starting younger. I would like to ask him if he's familiar with the acronym ACEs, Adverse Childhood Events. I mean, there's been a big movement, at least here on the West Coast, to understand the implications of children or adults who at one time when they were children have significant amount of adverse childhood events, which go on to be somewhat predictive significantly of severe mental and emotional challenges or coping issues moving forward into their adult life.
I'm familiar with that, and that's a very clear indication of why services need to be available that early on. But even short of significant trauma and those kinds of adverse effects, there are a whole range of problems that you can start to see developing early that need attention as well, and could be instrumental in preventing them from developing into something more severe.
Camilla, I'm going to ask you to bow out because we don't have much time and let some other callers, but go ahead. Go ahead, Kevin.
Thanks for that call. I appreciated it. I was born into a dysfunctional family. My father was a alcoholic, and my mother had a significant chronic pain and on and off drug addiction, and it was extremely chaotic. Had lots and lots of intersections with trauma, abuse, and I'm sure that caused some of the trajectory of the challenges when I moved into early adulthood in struggling with mental and emotional states of body and mind.
Well, obviously, in the way our culture is set up with you know, mandatory education, largely public, but there's moves you know, towards privatization. Anyway, won't go into all that, but schools are often called upon to deal with sort of a in loco parentis, or whatever the term is. They're sort of used as a way to because kids are all there together, and if one kid is acting in such a way that disrupts the classroom, obviously that's going to be a problem, not just for the kid, but for the kids around and for the learning situation. Obviously, there's cops in schools have been called upon, just like cops on the streets, to deal with these. So that's an issue. But I just sort of want to flag that we could go in that direction, or maybe I'll just throw it out to Teresa and then let you respond to what I just said and what Teresa is going to say. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning. I've been working in mental health for many years right now on the inpatient unit, and one of the solutions I would like to see is you know how they have all levels of assisted living for elders? I would like to see all levels of living for folks with mental health issues, so that we would have basic independent living all the way up to, you know, fully 24-hour care, but that people could move between them as needed. So that's my vision for something unique and helpful in Portland.
Kevin?
Yeah, very good. I sometimes think about that myself, and I would like to refer you, maybe you're familiar with it, but the 500-year history of Geheel, G-H-E-E-L, Belgium, in which there were actually, it's been told, that folks suffering from, you know, madness, what they called it back then, would make pilgrimages or Mecca to Geheel because of the community and because of the support that they would get from the people who would live there, and the way that their hospital or their institution functioned during the evening versus during the day, where they would purportedly open the doors and let them mix and make friendships with the local community. I really think that that particular idea around, you know, having independent living but close by, there are supports for people, i.e. peer respite, i.e. A psychiatric crisis facility of some sort, that a person in close proximity could check in, touch base, that sort of thing, and not have to be, you know, I mean, if you're in far out in Washington, in Clackamas County, and you're having a psychiatric crisis, the goal is to take you to Unity Psych Hospital, near in the Rose Quarter. That's a long way away from your house, from your community, from your neighborhood, and then to, you know, and those sort of things, I think, have some impact on people. I agree completely with what the caller said. Let me just put out some math out there roughly. In my modeling, to stay in a acute psychiatric lock bed in the Portland area, somewhere between $1,500 and $2,000 a day per patient, per client. My model, this peer respite project that I've been pushing for the last 4.5, 5 years, is on this current funding model, 18 peer respite beds available, if we can birth three of these projects with six beds. My modeling is roughly that what we're asking the state of Oregon for is $342 a day per respite bed, compared with the psych hospitalization locked clinical setting of $1,500 to $2,000 a day. Are there 18 people in Oregon who this morning might value go to a peer respite, and 2 days from now are going to be in such terrible, distraught shape and lose executive command or their ability to self-manage, end up in the higher level of care? I think the goal should be to keep people out of institutions as much as possible and solve them connected to your home and your community as much as possible. It's institutionalization, under such distress, is traumatizing itself. Socially, it's traumatizing. I refer to myself as a person who's had multiple psychotic experiences. Some people don't like that language, but for shorthand, I use that. The state of vulnerability when I am under these psychotic states is extreme. Mixing me with 20 or 30 other people in a locked place and everybody's unfamiliar, who do I trust and how do I cope? Those things are primary and instrumental in what happens to my care and in the journey forward. And I
okay, Kevin, let me let Teresa, if you're still there, before I let you go, go ahead and add further thoughts.
I was just going to say I agree with what our host guest is saying, and that there are at least 18 people right now on the inpatient units in Portland who would love and would benefit from stepping down to a peer respite. And, that we are having such difficulties getting people to a safe discharge, especially people who come into us who have been living on the street or who have been living in motels with no support. So, yes, totally agree with you, and thank you for your vision.
Okay, thank you, Teresa. Once again, the number is 503-231-8187. Apologies for the somewhat reduced call-in time, and also the fact that we have fewer phone lines available. But you have 5 minutes left to call in to me, Paul Rowland, the regular host of Wednesday Talk Radio, and my guest, Kevin Fitz. We're talking about new approaches to people in mental emotional crisis. We're talking about House Bill 2980, which would provide funding for 3 peer respite centers, which are short-term home-like facilities for people experiencing mental health crises. We talked about the Portland Street Response Team as another hopeful experimental approach, which has also been part of the discussion of a police reform. We haven't talked so much about the issue of race in all this, although Kevin, because obviously people living under white supremacy suffer disproportionately the traumatic effects of the system and are often more prone to the kind of psychic stress that lead to these sorts of episodes. But Kevin did mention that there's discussion of to having either a tribal or BIPOC-led peer respite center, and obviously that has to be included in the conversation. But as we're waiting for someone, or perhaps our last caller, 503-231-8187, to join the conversation, I had something I wanted to go to. Let me just turn it back to you. What are as we go forward with this, obviously you've been working on this a long time. Do you see this, obviously you see this as coming closer to reality. So who would be running these peer respite centers once they come into being?
So the language in the legislation designates a peer run organization, and then it has a paragraph that goes on to define what a peer run organization is, what type of services it is. Remember, I talked about it's a non-medical facility. It's not a medicalized facility. There's not doctors there. There's not nurses there. So the funding model doesn't come from the Medicaid system in the model that we're pushing in Oregon particularly. One of the things I think fundamentally to understand, we have not done this, at least in the last 2 decades, formally in Oregon. There is thank you so much for that previous caller. I totally believe it too. There are probably 18 people in the Tri-County area that, had there been an opportunity somewhere, previous to their hospitalization, could say, we have this peer respite. You know that your friend from your support group is familiar with that, or they found that useful. Maybe that might be something that you could need, that you would value and find support with. I also want to say, Paul, I don't think that we should be pushing any myths of total system tune-up that's going to solve all these problems. I wish that we, and I wish the mayor, and I wish the governor and the county chair would level us. There's going to be a significant amount of people who are struggling, and the basis of that, one of the foundations of that, is their houselessness. I've been told that 3 out of 10, or maybe 4 out of 10, admits and discharges at Unity are people who are completely houseless or housing insecure. It's very expensive to use our psychiatric hospitals for short-term housing for people without housing.
Let me just interrupt you again, because we do have a last caller, and I want to respect them and let them get their word in, and then you'll have the last word, Kevin. Go ahead, Kathy. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hello. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you're on the air.
Okay. I just wanted to say that the concept of mentally ill in general is really connected with stress and woundedness, and any time that you are either in a state like that yourself or around someone who is in a state like that, the really, really important thing is to be kind to them and to think about what their needs might be and to protect them from harm. And anyone can do this anywhere in the community. And, of course, the whole community needs more community sense, and we'll have less mental illness in the first place.
Okay, I'm going to have to let you go with that. That was very short and to the point. Last word to you, Kevin.
Yeah, I just want to say thank goodness for people like you, Paul, and the individual practitioners and everybody who's putting their shoulder to raise consciousness raise awareness around the people who are suffering terribly in our midst. And I agree 100%. Nonviolent, non-coercive, where you can bond with trust and proven results and a community that you can be connected to and a safe place to sleep ought to be primary if we're trying to address this issue. And I think we're going to be pushing this stuff for quite a long time, because I don't think what's in the pipes are enough to deal with the crisis, the existential crisis that we as a city and a state are facing with some of these challenges. But I appreciate
that statistic. Kathy, we got to let you go because we're just out of time. Thank you for calling in, though. Just that statistic, 3 or 4 out of 10 people admitted to Unity Center having throes of houselessness can't be more to the point than that about part of the deeply economic nature of the crisis that we're in. But with that, we got to go. Thank you so much, Kevin Fitz.
Thanks, Paul.
As always, Steve. All right. And that's it for this show. I'm Paul Rowland with Wednesday Talk Radio. Stay tuned for more great programming here on KBOO. Bye, everybody.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 8:59 a.m.
This is Judy Berry from Earth First, and when I'm in Portland, I listen to non-commercial community radio, KBOO, Portland, no compromise in defense of the truth.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1930.